Support for Faith Matters comes from the law offices of Mullen, Hoard, and Brown, LLP, offering a full range of legal services to regional and national clients. Mullen, Hoard, and Brown are members of ALFA International. More information is available at 765-7491 or mullenhoard.com.
Welcome to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Medical Center. For over 35 years, Covenant has provided everything from routine community health screenings to advanced heart procedures, and serves as the only certified chest pain center in the region. Now here's your host, Tom McGovern.
I'm Tom McGovern, host of Faith Matters. And this Sunday afternoon, we are delighted to have as our special guest, Dr. Philip Gorski. Philip is the author of a very wonderful recent book, American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present, which is published by Princeton University Press. Phil, welcome to Lubbock, and welcome to our conversation about your wonderful book this Sunday afternoon.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. I'm very happy to be here with you.
You teach at Yale?
Yes, I do. I'm professor of sociology and religious studies here at Yale.
How long have you been there?
Well, I've been here for quite a long time now, 2004, so 13 years.
When we were talking about the inspiration for the book, you said you had an epiphany on the road, or shall we say the railroad, between New Haven and Philadelphia that gave you the idea for this book?
Well, that's right, Tom. This was in the spring of 2008. Barack Obama had just given his famous speech on race. Your listeners will probably recall there had been quite a scandal about videos that had been released of Obama's then pastor, Jeremiah Wright, who had some very, very critical things to say about the United States. For a while, Obama had just waited for this to blow over, but at a certain point, he felt that he really had to confront the issue. And so he gave this widely praised speech on race. But what really struck me about it at the time was that the setting to begin with was a bit unusual for a speech on race. You might have expected him to go to one of the sacred sites of the civil rights movement, like Martin Luther King's church in Atlanta, the Ebenezer Baptist Church. You might have expected him to quote directly from King or perhaps from another icon such as Frederick Douglass. That's not what he did. He went to the Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and he opened his speech by citing from the preamble to the Constitution, We the People. What struck me about this at the time was that I heard echoes of what my graduate school mentor, Robert Bella, had called the American civil religious tradition.
Setting for our listeners, U.S. civil religious tradition, you place that between two extremes or two opposite, perhaps, points of view.
Yes, I think it's the via media, or if you like, I sometimes also refer to it as the vital center of our public life. I think it does sit between these two extremes. Radical secularists want to understand American history and the American project in purely secular terms, and religious nationalists want to understand it in purely religious terms. What's unusual about the civil religious tradition is that it's both civil and religious, both secular and religious. In that sense, I think really creates a space where people of faith and people of no faith can engage with each other again, or could engage with one another again if they chose to.
I love the quote from William Butler Yeats. Yeats speaks in The Second Coming, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The best lack all convictions, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." I've taken a little, Phil, from the longer quote from W.B. Yeats. You believe ardently as a historian and as a sociologist and as a student of religion that this vital central core is absolutely indispensable to our well-being.
Yes, I do. Every time I hear that W.B. Yeats passage, it sounds more and more prophetic, more and more like a description of our current situation to me. The best lack all conviction. They feel indifferent. They feel apathetic. They feel cynical, while the worst are utterly sure of their views. And so it's the people at the extremes who increasingly define and dominate our public discussion, to the point that it's no discussion at all anymore, but just the shouting match. And it certainly does feel like that's where we're at sometimes right now, doesn't it?
It does. And your appeal, though, to the center where most people reside, the moderates, who could find in civil religion a place of dialogue and a place where we can come together and from a position of value without compromising in any way our religious beliefs, place of civil religion where we can articulate our vision and also the solutions to our many problems. Would you agree with that?
I would. And I would say that you can be a part of the vital center even if you're not entirely moderate in your views. You just have to be civil in the way that you engage with other people and to extend them some measure of civic friendship, which is to say to realize that we're sort of in this together. I think there's sometimes a fantasy that somehow if we could just get rid of those other people, then everything would be all right. But we can't do that. We have to figure out some way to live together. And that may mean, you know, restraining ourselves sometimes and making hard compromises with each other where we really have to give a lot.
Phil, you embrace a magnificent swath of American history from the Puritans to the present time. And let's go back to our beginnings. I'm Irish, early at Texas Tech, our university here. I was introduced by a wonderful professor, Larry Graves. He introduced me to some of the great writers of the Puritan days, and I was absolutely captivated by them. What can you say to us about the Puritan contribution to civil religion?
I think the greatest contribution that they have made to the civil religion is to think about the American project in terms of the Exodus story in the Hebrew scriptures. You can see why the Exodus story would have resonated so strongly with them. And they too felt cast out or as if they were escaping from oppression, leaving England for New England. They weren't sent out into a desert, but into what they referred to as a howling wilderness. I think it's hard for us to even remember or imagine how kind of harsh and difficult the conditions would have been here in Connecticut or in Massachusetts for people who were arriving in the 17th century. They were quite determined really to forge an exemplary community together. I mean, that was just the other thing I really admire about them is their tremendous moral and political seriousness. You know, they were really trying to do something very, very difficult and very, very important. And I think that's a story that many of us can still resonate with today. All of us, except for the descendants of the native peoples, were immigrants. Our ancestors were immigrants. You know, all of us sought something in coming here, some kind of freedom, some sort of community that we couldn't realize in our original home countries. The Exodus narrative is still one that really resonates also in the sense that we're people made up of multiple tribes, if you like, who have to find a way of getting along with one another. And the way that we do that is by embracing a certain covenant, certain set of political ideals that are at the foundation of the country, freedom, equality, inclusion, solidarity. That would be my rendering of our civic creed.
I'd like just to finish this segment with a brief quote from the Puritan experience where you write, and still the greatest legacy of the Puritan founding is surely the Exodus narrative itself. The story of oppression, flight, and freedom has long had and still has an abiding resonance for an emigrant nation like the United States. Phil, we'll take a brief pause now and then we'll come back to continue this great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Tom McGovern. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Medical Center. More information on the different causes of chest pain can be found at covenanthealth.org/heart.
Support for Faith Matters comes from Hospice of Lubbock, serving the 19-county South Plains region since 1986. The staff offers faith-based end-of-life care for both children and adult patients. More information is available at hospiceoflubbock.org.
Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Now again, your host, Tom McGovern.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. It's our special delight this Sunday afternoon to have as our special guest author, Dr. Philip Gorski. Philip is the author of a wonderful new book, American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present, published by Princeton University Press. In Chapter 3, in speaking of the American Revolution, you speak of it as the second founding. Would you enlighten us a little on the second founding?
So in many ways, it echoed but also deepened the first foundings. First founding had really drawn above all on the biblical story of the Exodus, but had also drawn on Republican theories of self-government. With the Revolution revitalized those two threads, one of the most interesting discoveries that I made in writing the book was the way in which the ideal to which many of the founders appealed was what they understood as the Hebrew Republic. This is an allusion to an important passage in 1 Samuel 8, in which the prophet Samuel warns the people of Israel against their desire for a monarchy, which he portrays as potentially leading to a kind of idolatry in which one places all of one's hopes in an earthly master rather than in one's fellow peoples and in one's divine ruler. For them, though, this was a way of blending together in this idea of the Hebrew Republic, the project of self-government with this older idea of a people who was made through a covenant. So that was quite an interesting discovery. And that, I think, is the way in which they reclaim and deepen this idea of the Exodus story and its relationship to self-government.
You talk about certain prototypes in terms of the overall thesis of your book, religious nationalism and the conflict and its opposite, radical secularism. What vestiges of this do you find in the revolutionary period?
Of religious nationalism?
Both of them, yeah, or perhaps.
Religious nationalism, as I understand it, is a kind of chauvinistic hyper-patriotism that thinks about the nation in terms of blood, blood sacrifice, of blood conquest, blood belonging. And I trace the beginnings of this to the second and third generations of Puritans who understood there are conflicts with the native peoples in terms of kind of apocalyptic terms of a struggle between good and evil, heaven and hell. This is really, interestingly, not so prominent during the Revolution. I think the Revolution was appeared really when Republican ideal, this civil religious tradition, was really very, very dominant.
Out of that, we moved in, and this is taking a huge leap for a historian, from the Revolution then to the Civil War, which you describe very succinctly as the first refounding in Chapter 4 in the description of the Civil War, especially in the Reconstruction period. As you describe it, radical secularism has arrived.
This is a period after the Civil War when there are various forms of free thinking and social Darwinism and libertarian ideology arrive in the United States from Western Europe. You have a number of people, most prominently the freethinker Robert Ingersoll, who are pressing for a very, very radical separation of religion and politics, one that goes far beyond the institutional separation of church and state envisioned by the founders so far that they suggest, Ingersoll, for example, and some of his followers suggest that not just that any law that appears to be inspired by religious values should be stricken from the books. And just very, very radical vision that would really exclude religious voices, values, symbols completely from the public square. This is really, again, I think at odds with the vision of the United States that people like Abraham Lincoln or Frederick Douglass enunciated during this period. If you've ever read or heard Abraham Lincoln's Second Inaugural, you'll know it is full of scriptural allusion, that there's a sense in which he saw kind of a grim operations of divine providence working themselves out during the Civil War in which the sort of sin of slavery was being atoned for by both the North and the South in that very, very costly conflict.
In Chapter 5, moving into the progressive era of the book, where you recount through Dewey and through Jane Addams and W.E.B. Du Bois, I would like you, in this particular period, I have great admiration for Reinhold Niebuhr. In terms of a religious, very significant religious voice in the progressive era, which would be, I guess, the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, what particular significance do you attribute to Reinhold in this dialogue we're having this afternoon?
Reinhold Niebuhr was known to many as America's prophet. He was the person who recaptured the prophetic tradition of the Jeremiad, in which a people is upbraided for their sins against their founding covenant, for their pride and their covetousness. And Niebuhr really understood pride as the original sin. He believed that individual and collective pride is something that really can't be extinguished completely, but is something that must always be guarded against. He was especially worried about collective forms of pride. And the one that he worried most about was what he, like I, called religious nationalism. The appeal of religious nationalism is that it injects a kind of sacred purpose. It sort of elevates a common person, you know, above their failings and their finitude. It makes the nation look as if it's purely a force for good and never for evil in the world. And it arms that conceit with all of the destructive power of the modern state and the modern military. That sense of consciousness of the way in which we constantly fall short of our ideals, the way in which America has not always been a force for good in the world, even though it sometimes has, I think it's really important for us to be reflective in that way and be reminded of the ways in which we failed and not always just celebrated for the things that we've been successful at. And I think there's oftentimes too little of that.
Thank you, Phil. At this point, we'll take a short break. And when we come back, we will pick up the conversation with post-World War II and then lead into your conclusions and your advice for us going forward.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Tom McGovern. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Medical Center. More information on the different causes of chest pain can be found at covenanthealth.org/heart.
The views, opinions, and comments that are expressed on this program are solely those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect or represent the views and opinions of KTTZ-FM, Texas Tech Public Media, Texas Tech University System, or our faculty and staff, our affiliates, our partners, and our sponsors.
Support for Faith Matters comes from Hospice of Lubbock, serving the 19-county South Plains region since 1986. The staff offers faith-based end-of-life care for both children and adult patients. More information is available at hospiceoflubbock.org.
Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Now again, your host, Tom McGovern.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm your host, Tom McGovern. This Sunday afternoon, it's a delight to be in conversation with Philip Gorski, who is the author of American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present. Phil, I want you just to comment, if you will, on the advent, which you cover in Chapter 6, especially in the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King. What particular significance do you attach to Martin Luther King, both in what he wrote and what he did?
There's so much to say there. It's hard to know where to begin. He was a person who really was able to take this prophetic tradition of the Jeremiah that had been so important to Niebuhr, blend it with the rhetorical homiletic tradition of the Black Church in a way that was just incredibly powerful and inspiring for so many Americans. I think there are a few of us even now who can listen to some of these speeches of King's without tearing up. They just speak so deeply to us. They just resonate so powerfully with the mystic chord of our memory. One of the great contributions of his, of course, was to urge us to think about the United States as multi-faith and multi-ethnic, but not to give up on the dream of achieving what he would often call the beloved community. Some moments, however, fleeting of common purpose and genuine unity. And I think that's something that we're still called to today. I think there are too many folks who either want to retreat into their own individual lives, or maybe they want to retreat into, you know, their own ethnic or cultural community and leave behind this sort of common project. But I don't think that the country can survive unless we continue to seek this beloved community about which Martin Luther King spoke so powerfully.
You note that in Chapter 7, which is just jumping forward a little, that there was a jettison of civil religion on the Democratic side in some of the thinking, and then on the other side, on perhaps on the conservative Republican side, there was the corruption, if you will, of civil religion. Does that set a context for the present as far as you're concerned?
Well, yes, I think it does. You know, on the Democratic side have been many leaders who speak a kind of dry, uninspiring, technocratic language that doesn't inspire anybody, that doesn't unify us, that doesn't give us some sense of common purpose, and doesn't connect us to sort of wellsprings of the tradition that we share in a compelling way. That's the danger on that side, and the danger on the Republican side, I think, has been to corrupt this civil religious tradition, to take away the bitter salt of the prophetic voice, to say, you know, America is always and everywhere a force for good. We are already a shining city on a hill. Everybody should want to emulate us. If they don't, then we're going to change them and make them look more like us, go on a crusade of some kind. And I think that is one of the real problems in our politics at the moment.
You have some recommendation, which I love, at the end of your book. You're not just a theoretician who throws out these wonderful ideals for us and try and figure out what we do with them. You recommend, among other things, the removing big money from political process, making civic holidays into holidays again, to make character education as part of civic education, and then to establish a universal system of national service. How do you see this universal system of national service?
One of our problems is that we're not just divided from one another right now politically. We're divided from one another geographically. We've increasingly sorted ourselves into communities of people who have the same incomes, the same politics, the same religious beliefs, the same cultural pastimes as we do. And we really are quite ignorant, I think, oftentimes, of people who are different from us, even if they only live a few miles away from us. This is something that really has, I think, eroded our trust with one another. And so I think one of the great things about a system of national service would be it would bring folks from many different walks of life together again when they're young at a formative period in their lives, and create this sense of commonality, of understanding, of purpose that was lost. I think one of the reasons why the decades after World War II were a period of relative political comedy for quite a while was because of the war effort. I'm not recommending that we go out and fight more foreign wars, on the contrary, but that we seek to do great things together again. That's what I have in mind when I talk about rebuilding a system of national service. And that could be military service. It could be working in a drug rehabilitation program. It could be rebuilding some of our national parks. It could be rebuilding our infrastructure, all of the above.
Philip, on page 233 of your book, beginning with rebuilding the vital center will not be easy. So our listeners can get a flavor of the author reading his own work. Read that paragraph for us. Rebuilding the vital center will not be easy. And then, if you will, from the next paragraph, take a point or two from that for us.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Rebuilding the vital center will not be easy, but it is imperative. Our constitutional system cannot function without a vital center. It is not a winner-take-all system such as Great Britain has. It protects the rights of the minority. It allows for divided government. It establishes a system of judicial review. In a word, it requires compromise. The vital center must be rebuilt from within civil society. Our party system is a hostile environment for the vital center. It's first past the post rules in which there's no second prize, encourages candidates to pull out all the stops, rhetorical, ideological, financial, and even legal, in a no-holds-barred effort to win. This is why we cannot rely on professional politicians to do the job. We must do it ourselves. And I think there is a sense in which we really need to rediscover our civic life in the sense of our local life, to work more on the local level and to really seek out people who might be from another town or from another faith community or another cultural background, and to do that in a really, really intentional way. I know there are plenty of politicians out there of good intention and goodwill and great talent, but I think that at this point, the partisan political system is really working at cross purposes with the American project, and it's something that's going to have to be rebuilt from the bottom up. And I know there are many people who are already doing this. More of us need to be doing this.
Thanks, Philip. I'd like a compliment, kudos to Chuck here, who plans these programs with us. And what we've been doing locally, I mentioned to you that we have a wonderful dialogue between the various communities of faith, not just talking about what we share, what we don't share, but working together. And I love the hope that you have. You shared it on the Charlie Rose program too. This vital center is the local community, and local communities working together with openness, working across differences, true differences, that we can recreate the vital center. Would you agree?
That is certainly my hope. And I'm always hopeful.
I know you're hopeful, and so am I. And Philip, it's been an absolutely delight to have you with us this Sunday afternoon. And again, I would urge our listeners, if you want a good read, American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from Puritans to the Present, written by Philip Gorski, published by the Princeton University Press. Philip, our thanks to you and to your colleagues at Yale for making this cross-country dialogue possible this afternoon, to our esteemed producer here, Chuck Luck, for making this possible. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you so much, Tom and Chuck, and also to all of your listeners.
You've been listening to Faith Matters with your host, Tom McGovern. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Medical Center, home of Lubbock's only certified chest pain center. Join us next Sunday for another edition of Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1, a service of Texas Tech Public Media.